Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Denis Rancourt. Denis is a distinguished tenured professor of physics, a recognized expert, an environmental science expert from the University of Ottawa. Denis has been on before. We've talked about his situation and the outrageous things that were done to him. A man who deserves all the praise that is his due based on who he is, his expertise in his fields, his pedagogic expertise and how students reacted to him, his support for what I like to call right over wrong. It's good to have Denis back. Denis, I just want to make a couple of comments before we jump into letting you take over.
Yeah, and it's give a pleasure to be here, Stephen.
Oh, Denis, it's a great honor for me to have you and to talk about your situation, because people abuse, it doesn't matter whether they're noted people or just ordinary people, the abuse of people in Western societies, especially in America and Canada. People don't think about Canada. Denis is up in Canada. People think of Canada as some kind of a, maybe out of the mainstream country. My goodness, well, Canada is a NATO country. I think that really says it all. NATO's a killing machine. And NATO is very much, Canada is very much a part of that. Canada is more supportive of Israel than even America is. It's astonishing to say that, but that's what got Denis in trouble. For supporting right over wrong, for supporting the Palestinians, he got routed out of the University of Ottawa. But let me just make a couple of comments. I generally get out a couple of articles a day. I've got a couple in mind for tomorrow. They're basically done. I'll finish them up later this afternoon. Between presidential terms, when a president has two terms, there's usually a pretty good transition. I've written about a number of the changes taking place. John Kerry replacing Hillary Clinton. I'll get back to her in a minute. Jack Lew at Treasury replacing Tim Geithner. I wrote a profile on both of them. Mary Shapiro left the SEC back in December. She had an interim replacement. SEC is a Wall Street tool. That's what the SEC doesn't enforce. SEC endorses the worst of Wall Street crimes by simply shoving them under the rug. Well, now there's a woman named Mary Jo White in charge. I wrote a profile of her. I called my article, Wall Street's in Good Hands with Mary Jo White. Sure as hell is. I'll probably do some more, but I've got an article tomorrow about Hillary Clinton. She stepped down on the 1st of February. Oh, I've given her a massaging throughout the last 4 years as part of other articles. She's a war goddess. She's one of the most hawkish people in Washington. I had a mini debate, and I mentioned it on the program, I think yesterday, maybe one other time. A good meaning reader of my articles who just couldn't imagine a better outcome than Hillary being a presidential candidate in 2016. I couldn't convince her that she had her logic absolutely upside down. I can't imagine a worse presidential aspirant than Hillary Clinton. Well, there's no question that I think that she'll run. It's a long time between now and 2016. Anything can happen. But she'll be 69 then. She's 65 now. She's young. My God, I'm 9 years older than she is, and I'm going strong. Oh, she wants the job. She wanted it badly in 2008. I quoted her in my article back then saying, quote, I'm in to win. That was her line. Well, she's in to win in 2016, barring whatever may change between now and then. Maybe the world will come to an end based on the way the things that are going on. But I wrote a detailed profile about her. I hoisted her on her own petard. Yeah, I hanged her. Absolutely, I hanged her. I used her own words. I mean, she is so extremely militant. She's more militant than Joe Lieberman. He's as militant, or more Lieberman, than John McCain. The stuff that came out of her mouth when she was in the U.S. Senate as Secretary of State, well, you know the old line from My Fair Lady, it was enough to make a sailor blush. Well, it infuriated me, and I quoted her verbatim. So there she is. She's out. I don't know what she's going to write her memoirs, I think. You know, she'll cash in for a few million bucks. Her husband, Bill, did. Bill wants her to run. Well, he wants to move back into the White House. What else does he want? 8 years weren't enough. He wants another 8 years. Well, I think Hillary will run in 2016. But read my article when it comes out. And the title of my article is, gee, I write so many, I forget my titles. The title is Hillary Clinton, Profile of Imperial Arrogance and Lawlessness. And I think in a phrase that about sums her up. And again, information is right there, black and white. I didn't say it. She said it. I quoted her, and then I extrapolated from what she said. I've got another one coming out tomorrow, too, but I'll stop at that point. Penny, welcome to the program.
Oh, yeah. I'm happy to be here. You know, if Hillary Clinton could fire you, Stephen, she would.
She must know about me by now. I think there have to be people in the Obama administration and the Israeli government who know about me because I write about them so often and talk about them on air. And other people, I think, pick up on some of what I write and may cite me or quote me or whatever. I mean, they're surveilling everybody, Denny. We live in a total surveillance society. I mean, Orwell, you know, Orwell, Big Brother. Yeah. Well, he didn't know the technology. He imagined some of what might exist today. But we literally live in a total technology, a total surveillance society.
At the University of Ottawa, there are more than 800 surveillance cameras on campus.
Oh, just on campus alone.
Yes. I mean, recently, I did an access to information request just recently about me for a short period of 6 months, and I got a huge stack of photographs and videos and electronic files of all kinds. Every time I would step foot on campus, they would follow me around. They would write reports about it. They were picturing every move. Everything I had in my hands, they would have a close-up of what I had in my hand. It's just unbelievable. I would go to my radio show. They would follow me there. You could follow the pictures everywhere. They would take pictures of the license plate of my car as soon as I would drive into the campus. It's frightening. It's frightening, the degree of surveillance of university professors on a campus. You can imagine what it might be like in other environments, you know.
This is why you were still there, before they barred you from campus.
Yeah, this is while I was a tenured full professor.
That is really shocking. A state university, you would think that would be hallowed ground. Well, it's not hallowed ground. It's not hallowed ground in America. And I don't know what goes on at all the universities. Way back in the 1950s, when I was in college and grad school, Denny, it certainly was not that way. But it certainly has changed over the years.
And I find it stunning the extent to which people agree to function in an environment where they're constantly in the eye of a camera. In any hallway or classroom or boardroom or anywhere, you're always in the eye of a camera. I find that unbearable, despicable. It's like some of the worst futuristic horror movies of dystopia, and it's the real thing now on university campuses. Unbelievable that people just put up with it. I mean, I think if we had the students we had in the 60s, they would be putting black spray paint on all those cameras. You know, they would be there would be revolt about how the institution is surveilling their every move and how that's an invasion of privacy, that it's against their fundamental rights as free citizens who have free association by right and so on. I find it difficult to believe the extent to which students and citizens accept this degree of surveillance.
I think one of the reasons is most people don't think about it. They don't pay any attention to it.
They don't have the experience of being threatened by it.
Oh, correctly. Absolutely. It does not touch their lives. And when your government says the only thing we want to do is get rid of the bad guys, too many people believe it. And again, the key thing is what you just said. It does not touch their lives directly. If it ever did, or somebody close to them, that would change the ball game for them.
Yes.
I must add, Denny, that Chicago, I think at one time it was the most heavily surveilled city in America. I don't know whether it's that case now, but it certainly is one of the most heavily surveilled, with cameras all over the place. I think the ones on the street are very high on lampposts, you know, the lighting lampposts, and they have something that may look like a bulb. People don't even know what it is.
Right.
And when I go out on the street, I don't go looking around to see where's the closest camera, but they've got them there. They've got them in buildings and shopping malls. They've got them all over the place. You cannot escape the eye of a camera, so they're watching everything in case, what are they looking for? If somebody picks a pocket or something or other, there are no terrorists on the street.
And they know where you are. Anytime you make a phone call on your cell phone, they know at what time you take a picture from your cell phone. They know all of this stuff, right?
They sure do.
Unless you're very knowledgeable to erase it all. And, well, every time you make a payment with a credit card, I mean, they can trace you. It's a net, and they know exactly what you're doing, what your habits are, who you're associating with. It's unbelievable.
And the most frightening thing of all, and you've gone through it yourself, you've gone through it on the outside of a prison cell, but if they want to come after you, if they want to charge you with something, if they want to prosecute you and get you convicted, you're a dead duck. They
yes.
will get you. If they get you in a court, and I talked about this yesterday, and you get exonerated, they'll reconfigure the charges. They'll come back at you again. And
yeah.
if they fail again, they'll keep coming back at you. And if they never succeed in convicting you, they will keep you in a court of law for the rest of your life, making your life absolutely miserable.
Yes, it's one of the methods that they have. It's one of the ways they have to get rid of people, to smash groups of citizens who decide to resist and organize and be political in a way that is against the grain. This is one of the methods they have to smash you. They go after you with the courts. That's right. You know, the Crown comes after you and so on. Well, in Canada, it's the Crown, but the prosecutor. You know, Stephen, this brings us to the main topic that I wanted to share with you today. The idea of the courts. We're talking about the courts now. I want to convey to your audience the fact that in Canada, and I'm sure it's this way in the United States, you cannot, as a litigant in the courts, let's say you have to defend yourself, let's say you're dealing with this so-called justice system, you can never challenge the bias of a judge. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. The court assumes that whenever a judge makes a discretionary decision, one that he's entitled to make based on the evidence and the facts that he's looked at, that discretionary decision cannot be challenged by another judge, cannot be appealed, because it was within the first judge's discretion. So what that means is, if that judge is biased, and that bias is affecting his so-called discretionary decisions, then there is no way to question and to complain that there may be a bias there. The only way you can attack the bias of a judge is if the judge says something on the record that, or off the record, that shows a reason to believe that there would be bias. But if the judge just applies his or her discretion, makes all kinds of decisions in a case, which, you know, when you look at them, you say, oh my, isn't that stretching the limit, trying to please one side rather than the other? You can't ever say that. It's within the common law impossible to make that argument. It's not accepted in law. In other words, the law presupposes that the judges cannot be biased unless you can demonstrate that, you know, based on what they said, or that they have an outside contract with one of the parties, or that they talked privately with one of the parties. Unless you can demonstrate that, there is no way you can ask another judge to examine a decision or a series of decisions in view of it appearing to be biased, given how much it stretches the limits of this discretion. You can never do that. Structurally, it's impossible to do that. Now, that might not sound so bad to your listeners when I explain that, but the problem is, everybody knows, all the lawyers know, anyone who's ever studied the judicial system knows that judges side with the powerful. Bias is a feature, an objective feature of the so-called justice system. There's no question about that. Every sociologist, every anthropologist, anyone who's ever studied this institution knows that it's all about bias. Yet, in its structure, you cannot say that. You cannot make that criticism before the court. It's completely barred from you to make that criticism. Now, I find that, it's not surprising, because no institution will ever go against itself, and the real societal purpose of the courts is to sustain the status quo and to maintain power and the different power relationships. We know that from a societal knowledge perspective. But it's shocking when you think of it, because when you're a litigant and you're subjected to these decisions, and you know that, you know, if you had been someone else, it would have gone the other way, and you can see it, and it's plain as the nose on your face, well, you can never complain about that. In order for you to be able to complain about that, the judge has to slip up and say something like, well, you know, you're just a little nobody, I'm not going to side with you, or has to, you know, make that kind of an egregious error in terms of what the judge lets out, then you can use that and argue that there's an appearance of bias. You can't argue there's actual bias. You can't even do that, because that's considered too difficult to prove. You have to politely argue that a reasonable and informed person would conclude that there's an appearance of bias once the judge has this contract or whatever, you see? I mean, that's how impossible it is to deal with the judicial system.
And it's a very disturbing picture that you paint, and I think it's basically the same in America, where, again, the courts so often, especially the federal courts in America, I don't know how the Canadian system is structured. I guess there are federal courts. There must be provincial courts, maybe local courts. In America, you got federal, you got state.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah, it's the same in Canada. You start at the well, with a regular civil suit, you start at the provincial level, and then you go to the Court of Appeal within the province. Actually, in Ontario, there's even one in between the Court of Appeal and the provincial court. And then after the Court of Appeal, which is the highest court in the province, you go then to the Supreme Court of Canada. And I've done all of that. Not all of it, but I've been up to the Supreme Court, and I'm going there soon. I'm going to tell you the story of that as well. Which illustrates the general analysis that I just described to you just a moment ago. Do you want me to tell that story?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So I'm going to tell the story of a bias in the courts in my own case. Now, as you know, the University of Ottawa is funding, without a spending limit, one of its professors to sue me for defamation. So it's saying nominally that this is a private lawsuit by a professor, but actually, it's a professor at the university, and the university is entirely paying her all of her court costs, explicitly having said they're doing this without a spending limit. They said this on the record, under oath, and in order to sue me, in order to go after me, not to protect a professor that's being sued for something he or she did as part of her work, but rather to go after a third party, myself, who's been fired. And so they're doing that, and within that large process, I countersued, in a sense, it's called a motion, and I said, you can't do that. This is maintenance and champerty, those are the legal words. You have to, you know, as an institution using public funds, you cannot by proxy sue a third party to shut them up, because I have this blog, uofowatch.blogspot.com, where I'm very critical of the university, and that's what this lawsuit is about. It's about one of the articles on that blog. So anyway, I countersued, and as part of that countersuit, I ended up with a judge. Now listen to the story about the judge. This is absolutely incredible. This judge had a scholarship fund contract with the university, and the scholarship fund had the family name on it, the family name of the judge. The same judge had a boardroom with the family name on it in honor of a member of the family, in fact, the judge's son, and the boardroom was in this national law office of the lawyer that's representing the university, okay? Do you think maybe there's an appearance of bias here? Now, this judge did not disclose any of this when he was put in charge of my case. He simply didn't mention it. Now, then a newspaper article actually reported these facts, actually talked about the scholarship fund, talked about the boardroom honor, and interviewed the judge, who said he was very proud of these things and that these things were very important to him personally in terms of maintaining the memory of his deceased son, who had been a lawyer at the law firm and so on. Okay, so he's telling publicly, he's admitting that there are this contract and his boardroom honor, and that it's important to him, and that he's continuing to try to upkeep the legacy of his son and to keep that memory alive, that it's very emotionally important to him. He's saying this publicly in a newspaper article when he's being interviewed. That article comes out, and the judge then sees me in court and still doesn't disclose any of this stuff. Doesn't mention the article, doesn't mention what is in the article, still does not disclose this. And I hadn't seen the article at that time. When I did see the article, I don't know how many months later, the next time I was in the court, I said to the judge, listen, I would like to adjourn this session because I saw that newspaper article just the day before, roughly, I was in court the next time. So I immediately organized my thoughts and told the judge when I was at the hearing, I said, listen, I need to adjourn this hearing because I want to bring a motion that will ask you to recuse yourself on the grounds of reasonable apprehension of bias. Well, the judge, the polite way that they say it is that decorum was lost. The more direct way of saying it, if I were to comment on this, is that the judge lost it. And he was speaking at the top of his voice and repeatedly saying things like that he wouldn't hear of it. And he, at this point, threatened me with contempt of court, which is a criminal charge, if I continued to attempt to ask for this adjournment in order to bring this motion to recuse the judge. And then he took a short break. When he came back, he said, listen, there is no bias here, but I am going to recuse myself because what you tried to do in mentioning my deceased son and so on is so disturbing, so disgusting, that I cannot be objective with regards to you any longer. And then he recused himself.
As if he ever was objective in the first place, Denny.
Well, that's for people to decide. But the point is, he recused himself without ruling, without hearing my motion that he should recuse himself on the grounds of reasonable apprehension of bias, and without admitting bias. Now, that leaves me in a problem because he recused himself, but he had made lots of decisions in the past. If he had ruled on the question that I was putting before him, which was this reasonable apprehension of bias, and had found bias, then all of his prior decisions could not stand. They would have been annulled, and we would have had to have new decisions. Well, he didn't give me that right that I had to determine whether or not there was reasonable apprehension of bias in view of having all his past decisions overturned, okay? So what I had to do then was I had to put forward a motion to another judge of the same court asking for a judicial determination of whether or not there was reasonable apprehension of bias with regards to the first judge. Well, the second judge said, I won't even hear it. I will not hear your motion, and just dismissed it outright without hearing it. So then what I did was, when the decision on the motion that we were working on originally came out, I appealed the result of that decision on the grounds that many of the decisions within that motion had been made by the first judge, and therefore on the grounds of reasonable apprehension of bias, I appealed a motion. Now the motion in which I tried to appeal is called the leave to appeal motion. It goes to the same court. So I'm seeing a third judge of the same court now, and I'm saying, listen, the second judge wouldn't hear my motion. That's wrong. And the first judge also wouldn't hear the question of reasonable apprehension of bias. And I want to question his decision because there was reasonable apprehension of bias. Will you please hear my appeal? Well, the third judge said, no way. It's not important enough. Forget it. We're not going to hear this appeal. It's not important enough that I'm making a complaint of bias in the court on a $1 million defamation lawsuit. That's not important enough. He didn't really say it wasn't important enough. He said there's nothing here that would lead a reasonable person to think that there could even be reasonable apprehension of bias. It's just so weak. There's just nothing here it's not even reasonable to think that there would be bias. That was his argument. So that was the third judge. So then I looked at my options, And because I'd been denied a leave to appeal to the next higher court, it turned out I couldn't go to the next higher court. And I couldn't go to the court above it either, because there was case law that said, in a case like this, you can't go to us. So I was blocked, based on the case law, of going anywhere else. Now, when you can't go anywhere else, and you feel that there's been a decision against you that cannot be appealed anywhere, you have to go to the Supreme Court of Canada. So I did that. I filed an application for leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada. And when you do that, the Supreme, three judges of the Supreme Court of Canada have to look at your leave to appeal, consider it, and make a decision about whether or not they're going to hear this appeal. The problem is you first file it with the court. When you file it, there's an officer in charge called the Registrar of the Supreme Court of Canada, and his job is to look at your application and to decide if it's complete. Is there, have you forgotten something? Did you not sign one of the various certificates? Is everything in order? Did you follow all the rules? Well, my application was perfect. It was immaculate. There was nothing wrong with it. It's several hundred pages of a book that had been served to the other parties, six copies to the Supreme Court. Everything was in order. I paid my fees. And as soon as I served it and filed it like that, the other side, the big lawyers of the university and of the plaintiff, started writing directly to the registrar, arguing that the registrar shouldn't even accept my application. Never mind showing it to three judges, shouldn't even accept it. And their argument was that the Supreme Court did not have the jurisdiction to look at this. And so they just argued. They wrote three letters and argued this directly to the registrar. Then the registrar, I responded that this, it was against the rules to argue a substantive matter with the registrar. And I argued that the registrar didn't have the jurisdiction to not accept my application. He could only look at procedural things, not something that was as substantive as whether or not the Supreme Court had jurisdiction or not. Okay, so I replied that and said, listen, show it to a judge. You can't just bar this. Well, the registrar took some time to think about it and sent me a decision letter in which he said, I'm not accepting your application, and sent back the six books of the application and said, it appears that you may be able to go to another court, and therefore it may be premature to come to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court may not have jurisdiction here, something to that effect. Well, that's incredible, because it's like barring a citizen from entering the courtroom. It's like not even allowing you to get through the front gate. Not even allowing you your absolute right under the Supreme Court Act statute to have your application heard to see if they will receive the appeal and look at your complaint. Well, I thought that was shocking, and that just happened just days ago. So what I'm doing now is I'm in a position where the only thing left is for me to file a motion to the Supreme Court to overturn the registrar's order that he's not even going to file to assign a file number of the application, not even going to consider it. So I have to now appeal the registrar's action to a judge of the Supreme Court of Canada, and that's what I'm doing these days. Now, then the question becomes, what's going to happen when I try to file that motion? Is the registrar himself not going to accept and give a file number to a motion that is arguing that he didn't have the jurisdiction to not accept my previous application? You know, like, what is going to happen? I'm at the point now, I think they might even do that. I mean, so that the registrar himself, or is he going to give it to a judge who, and then the judge will decide that it can't be filed? And what will their reason be? Here I am following exactly the statutes, exactly the rules. It says when there's an order by the registrar, you can try to overturn it with a motion in this way and so on. I'm doing that. Let's see where that goes. But do you see what you have to do? Now, this is on a fundamental question, the question of bias of the courts. You know, one of the major principles of natural justice in the entire common law. It doesn't matter whether you're in Australia, the United States, or Canada, or anywhere. One of the founding principles of a justice system is that the court must be impartial. It's the number one thing. The other founding principle is that the judge has to hear both sides. You can't just hear one side and make a decision. You've got to hear the full arguments of both sides. Okay, those are the two founding principles of any justice system. Well, bias is one of them. So here's a situation where a citizen says, I've got a complaint of bias. There's a contract here with one of the parties. There's a boardroom that was named in honor of the judge's son. And it's a boardroom in the law firm of the lawyer of one of the parties. There's I think, a reasonable and informed person would conclude that there is a chance that there's at least an appearance of bias here, you see.
Boy, there sure is, Denny. We need to take a quick break. I'll make a comment about stuff that I've written about very, very briefly when we come back. It's an incredible story. You know the old saying, truth is stranger than fiction. Somebody put this in a Hollywood script. A lot of people wouldn't even believe it. But you're living it right now. Talking about, my goodness, the justice system. There really is a supreme injustice system. In America, let me just say one thing. I give a big endorsement to the folks at Project Censored. Mickey Huff comes on this program, Peter Phillips, Andy Roth. An extraordinary service, 37 years, I believe, goes back to the mid-1970s when Carl Jensen founded Project Censored. It really is marvelous. I've got I don't know how many of their books, their annual books, I've got on my shelves, 12 or 15 of them. I began reading them years ago, and I seem to get them annually now. Absolutely extraordinary, talking about the most important things that people need to know about that the major media simply ignores or whitewashes or misreports on. But that's another story. The judicial system, at the federal level in America, you've got the district, you've got the appeals level, you've got the Supreme Court. These are the ultimate arbiters in the federal system. They are so biased, so extremely right-wing. It's very, very, you can get an appellate case heard. That's not a supreme lift to have that happen. But to get a case to the Supreme Court, it comes close to Mission Impossible, and I've got a statement. When they turn you down, some weeks ago I wrote about one of the most egregious cases of injustice in America, the Holy Land Charity Foundation, people that, like Lynn Stewart that we've talked about in this program, people you should build a statue to. They should get the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest non-military award that America gives. That's what these people deserve. Instead, they get put in prison. Well, Lynn will appeal to the Supreme Court. It's my goodness, to say it's a 100-to-1 shot, she'll be lucky if it's only a 100-to-1 shot to even get her case heard, and she's been in prison 3 years now. The Holy Land.
That's an absolutely disturbing case.
Oh, it's very, very disturbing. Holy Land is very disturbing, too.
Yeah, I've read some of the background of Lynn's case. It's just very, very disturbing. What that has to mean that there is no America.
Oh, there is no America. Let me just read you what the Supreme Court says when they turn you down. They tell you nothing. And this I saved this. A lawyer sent me exactly what they say. A one-liner. You know, life and death is on the line.
Yeah.
And they send you a one-liner. And it says, opinion, petition for writ of certiorari to the United States Court of United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit denied. This is from the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yes.
Okay, to the United States. Well, the appeal is to the appeals court. Then it goes to the Supreme Court. It came from the Fifth Circuit. Denied is the operative word.
Yep.
So you've got about 10, 12 words.
Well, the assumption is that the lower court
Got it right.
Could not have made, in all likelihood, did not make an error of law, and therefore the higher court has discretion to look at, even consider whether there's going to be an appeal or not. And because there's such a high assumption that the lower court didn't make a mistake, they don't have to give a reason as to why they're not allowing the appeal. That's the logic that they're using.
You really is. That's exactly the logic they're using.
Yeah.
It really is disgusting because,
yeah,
again, I mean, there are a lot of cases that people appeal to the Supreme Court. None of them are unimportant, but some are more important than others. When glorious human beings get 60-year sentences behind bars, that's a life sentence. You put somebody in their 40s or 50s in prison for 60 years, and these are people the government wanted to put away, unless the world changes over a period of time. But right now, the way things are run in America, by either party, you know, there's a war on terror going. Dick Cheney, when he was around, said, "It's a war that will not end in our lifetime." I believe that's a direct quote from him back in the early 2000s. And that's the feeling of the Obama administration. It'll be the feeling in 2016. These people will never get out. And the Supreme Court dismisses them with a backhanded comment like this. That shows the way justice is in America, the same way it is in Canada, Denis.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what's more disturbing, the fact that the lower court would have found them guilty of something, or the fact that the higher court will not even consider the appeal. I think the first one is the bigger crime, because it, as soon as a lower court does that, you're in trouble for a long time. You know, before you crawl your way out of that one, a large part of your life and resources are gone. So these are huge crimes. Against people is what they are. They're the institutional crimes against people. That would be a better way of describing the justice system.
Oh, indeed, Eddie. And the district court judges, they have aspirations to become an appeals court judge. An appeals court judge has aspirations to become a Supreme Court judge. When the prosecutors go after somebody on an issue relating to quote-unquote terrorism, or in any case that the government thinks is important and they want to prosecute and convict somebody, if you go against what they want, you're going against the system. You're literally harming your own career prospects, so they don't dare do it. So they're all in the dirty system together. They play the same dirty game. One hand rubs the blood of one hand onto another, and innocent people get put behind bars. I don't know what the prison population of Canada is, Denis, but in America, it's by far the highest in the world. 2.4 million people. On a total numerical basis, it's the highest. On a per capita basis, it's the highest. It's higher than the prison population of China, with four times the population. There's no country that comes close to the numbers of people that America puts behind bars, and most of them don't belong there. That's the dirty part of it. You get nonviolent stuff that may rise to the level of misdemeanors. You don't put people in prison for long terms for misdemeanors. In some countries, I believe in Germany, you get slaps on the hand, you might get a fine, you might get a warning. They'll never put you in prison. Why spend all that money for nothing? Maybe that's their reasoning. Whatever their reasoning is, they don't do it. They certainly don't do it to the extent that America does it. And America can't wait to fill another prison bed, and you get a privatized segment of the industry, and they thrive on how many beds they fill. That's the name of the game with them.
Yeah.
So innocent people
Very
are simply
disturbing.
Commodities
Very disturbing.
For profit.
Yeah. Hey, Stephen, I've got some news for you.
Oh, what?
About me again. We're back to the topic of me.
Okay.
My book was just published.
Oh, marvelous.
Yeah,
marvelous.
It just came out. It's now available. It's a paperback. I'm really pleased with it, and I'm getting invitations, many invitations to have book launch events and so on, and there are two that are scheduled already. It just came out. It's called Hierarchy and Free Expression in the Fight Against Racism. And I mentioned the book on your show before, but
yes,
that was before it was published. Now it's published, and it's on the book's website is fightagainstracismbook.wordpress.com. So it's a WordPress website, Fight Against Racism book. And there you've got everything about it, the reviews, the endorsements, some really beautiful endorsements by leaders in the field of race justice and race studies and so on. I wanted to read one of the reviews that I'm really pleased about that just came in recently.
Oh, please.
It's not a back cover endorsement, but it's a student who read the book, and she wanted to meet me personally to tell me how it had changed her life and her career path. And then she wrote a very short review that I posted on the website. And I wanted to just read it for you. Her name is Hazel Gashoka. And she had this to say about the book. And she made a point to come and see me in Ottawa and to want to meet me and just to tell me everything that the book had done to her in her life. She changed her thesis topic. She's a graduate student in race studies, and she changed her thesis topic after she read the book. So here's what she said. It's very short. She said, as a black woman who is trained to read text through a critical race perspective, I had difficulties reading this book. It wasn't the book that was the problem, rather it was my theoretical framework. Although I agreed with the tenets in this book, I found the read to be a constant battle as I fought my desire to be part of the status quo. It is an incredible book, and I highly recommend it. So this is Hazel Gashoka, who has a BA in psychology and is now a graduate student in race studies. So that was very important to me, to know that the book could touch someone like that.
Denny, talk about what you covered in the book. We've got about 15 minutes left.
Okay. So the book is, there's a lot of things in the book, but overall, I think the one of the driving sort of movements in the book is that it's a very harsh criticism of the dominant paradigm in our society that the elites push about how to fight against racism. So the dominant paradigm in how to address racism in our multicultural societies is so-called critical race theory. And this critical race theory was initiated by lawyers, in fact. We were just talking about the legal system. Well, it's a bunch of progressive legal persons, lawyers that work in law schools and that were university professors and so on. They started writing essays and started developing these ideas called critical race theory. And these ideas became very prominent, in fact, became the dominant paradigm. This is what you learn at university when you do race studies, and this is what you learn about how to make society better. And now, I'm not the first person to criticize it. There have been some very prominent black and white critics of critical race theory. But my book is very straightforward and tries to go straight to the heart of what's wrong with critical race theory. And what I argue is that not only is it incorrect in terms of its ideas about how change occurs and the psychology of persons within a society, not only is it incorrect, but it actually serves to maintain a racial system and a racial stratification within society. That, in fact, it is produced by an elite class, that this theoretical framework is produced by an elite class of service intellectuals that, whether they know it or not, whether they're conscious of it or not, the whole network maintains hierarchy and its oppression and stops us from moving towards truly fighting racism. So it's a big challenge, this book, and it goes that far, and so it's very disturbing to a lot of people. It's disturbing to the people who are the service intellectuals that promote these ideas, but also to all the students who have learned them and who have accepted the ideas as part of their university training. So in that sense, the book is a challenge to a lot of people. And so what I do, instead of taking the modern critical race theory approach, is I go back to some of the main activists for social justice. I go back to Malcolm X, and I go back even further to an incredible white activist by the name of Mary Mother Jones, who was a workers' right activist, who is the single person, if you were to name someone, who put an end to child labor in America. So I go back to these people, and I look at their writings, and I look at their thoughts and their analysis, and it is counter to critical race theory. And it is closer to the heart of what is really needed to fight racism. And that includes, one of the points I make in the book is that in order to effectively fight racism, you've got to critique those who support it, those who support it through their, who play the role of being service intellectuals, who justify racism under the cover of fighting it. So you have to uncover all of that, and you have to actually be able to criticize these people. For example, Malcolm X said, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said he preferred the Southerners who were overtly racist and who said what they really thought and who spoke about themselves to the Northerners who didn't speak what they actually thought but who were down deep racist. He said he much preferred he could work with the people that were overtly stating their racism because you could have a discussion with them, you could challenge them on it, whereas it was much more difficult to get a handle on this kind of almost subconscious racism that is based on the idea that, well, we should disallow any kind of racist talk. As soon as you start to censor speech on either side of a debate, even on something as sensitive as racism, you're harming the individual and the individual's rights, and you're strengthening hierarchical control. As soon as you censor, that's what you're doing. And that's one of the main thrusts of my book, is to explain the extent to which that's true, how censorship, however you may call it and however you may justify it, can only serve the oppressive dominance hierarchy. And that as soon as you allow them, as soon as you allow free expression directly threatens the hierarchical system, necessarily, because the hierarchy is based on censorship. You have to stop the individual from expressing themselves, from being free. You have to box in, control, subdue, and crush the individual if you want a strong working hierarchy. And so I explain that battle, that constant battle between hierarchical expression, oppression, I mean, and the individual trying to discover themselves, trying to learn, trying to be emancipated, trying to search for freedom and a meaningful life. I explain that that is the fundamental battle in any hierarchy, because all hierarchies tend towards these oppressive hierarchies and tend to become more and more oppressive. And I explain why it's a natural tendency for a hierarchical system to move towards fascism. I explain the biological root of that. Actually, there's been some important medical discoveries that show how it is that our biology is such that we facilitate this kind of oppressive hierarchy. Did I ever tell you that story about how that works?
No, you never have. Let me just make one comment, Eddie.
Okay.
That you could say a form of censorship is the way it's done in America. There are lots of ways that it's done, but one way it's done is through the prison system. And a couple of years ago, I wrote about Michelle Alexander's book. She called it The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in an Age of Colorblindness. And she talked about that the new Jim Crow is a modern-day racial caste system. It has nothing to do with controlling crime. It's all about institutionalized racism. So if you want to get rid of elements in society that you don't want, you can just lock them up behind bars and you can create a lucrative business at the same time.
Absolutely.
So this is what goes on in America. The only other instance that I talk about institutional racism all the time is giving examples of what goes on occasionally in America, but all the time repeatedly, on what goes on by the Israelis against the Palestinians. I've got hundreds of examples, and I give it the term institutionalized racism.
Yeah.
It's official
yeah.
Israeli policy. It
yeah.
actually
I mean,
is.
Well, when we talk about racism, we immediately have to look at the class divide. We have to look at a lower oppressed class, but also it's geographical, because there's certain regions of the world, obviously, that are like a lower class, but they're also geographically distant. So we have to look at all of that. But within the middle class in privileged America, there is the appearance of a fight against racism. But in fact, that, I think, that fight, which is based on critical race theory, is actually just a mechanism of guilt alleviation. And it's a mechanism that supports the true system of class divide-based racism. So that's the intricate thing that I try to explain in a very systematic way in my book. So it's a real, it's a bit of an intellectual book, but it's written in a straightforward way. But I'm really trying to get at the roots so that people who are the students and the university professors and the intellectuals and the journalists, I'm challenging them directly to look at their own internal logic about racism. And I'm saying, if you think you're fighting racism by following these prescriptions, you're actually not. You're actually being hypocritical at the deepest level, and you're actually maintaining the hierarchy that you benefit from in your privileged position.
Danny, so, your book sounds absolutely extraordinary. I want to get into it more in a future program, but we're getting to the end of this program.
Yeah.
And because of the ordeal that you're still going through, obviously, and this can continue for a long time, and we brought this up in the program before, but in the couple of minutes we have left, explain to listeners how they can help you. You have exhausted your resources. You're beholden to people to do anything to try to help you fight a very ugly system that is literally persecuting you unjustly. Explain to listeners how they can help.
Well, that's the thing, is that this court battle, I'm going all the way. I'm being very resourceful. I'm being told that my legal arguments are of an outstanding quality. Even the judges and my opponents will say these things in court. And so I am doing everything I can to expose the incredible bias and injustice of the court system. But every time I lose one of these motions, I am forced to pay the costs, the legal costs of the other side. And as a result, I've had huge cost orders against me, far beyond what I can presently pay. They've completely exhausted all of my resources. And they're now threatening to go after my spouse's belongings and things like that, the house in particular. I mean, it's really getting ugly. So I'm at a point now where I need money just to be able to pay the fees to file my defenses and things like that. So there is a legal fund, and it's easy to find. You can go to one of my blogs. There's a PayPal button. If you go to, for example, Activist Teacher, the Activist Teacher blog, activistteacher, all one word, .blogspot.com, in the right-hand column at the top, there's a link there that's called Donate to the Denis Doncourt Legal Fund. And that leads you to a PayPal button and various ways that you can make a donation to my legal fund. These donations have been extremely helpful to me. When I produce these books for the Supreme Court of Canada, for example, you have to actually have them bound, photocopied, and everything. This costs hundreds of dollars. The court filing fees, again, more hundreds of dollars. So I'm trying to survive by asking people to donate what they can against these very vicious cost orders and lawyers who are doing everything they can to stop me in my defense, using costs against me.
So, and you're going up against Canada's most prestigious law firm.
Yes, two of Canada's largest law firms are involved.
Talk about David and Goliath, and you're holding your own. You're absolutely astounding them, Denny. Denny, I absolutely support you. Your case is so important. I mean, you're a monument to what justice should be, and it's you against a very unjust system. I hope listeners will respond, and they will help. I think if listeners forget what you just told them, simply Google Denis Rancourt, D-E-N-I-S, R-A-N-C-O-U-R-T. It'll take you right to Denny's site. You can help. Oh, Denny, absolutely. In plain English, we got to beat these bastards. Denny, I'm out of time. I'll email you off air, and I'll just remind listeners, join us every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit. Find out what you really need to know and do something about it.